I must have this thing. And we are very happy to have Carrie from Oregon speak tonight. So Carrie, if you're ready.
I am. Thank you so much, Sam. And thank you, Billy, for having me. Thank you to the group. My name is Carrie, and I am an alcoholic. I always have been, and I always will be. I have a sobriety date of March 25th, 2010. I have a home group. It's a beautiful New Horizons group in beautiful Bend, Oregon. We meet 6 days a week in downtown Bend. Currently, we are Zooming, and we are currently meeting 7 days a week. So feel free to Zoom on in at 12 o'clock noon Pacific, 3 o'clock Eastern, any day of the week. We would love to have you. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. And she knows that she's my sponsor. And I use her as a sponsor. And this is all the same woman. I sponsor women who sponsor women. And I know that they are my sponsees, and they know that I'm their sponsor. And for a minute there in my sobriety, I don't know, a couple of years, I started sponsoring so many women in name. That I heard somebody asked me once at some conference or something, I was speaking somewhere, and afterwards somebody said, how many people do you sponsor? And I said laughingly, because at the time I thought it was funny, and I don't anymore, oh, about half of them, right? And what I was saying was I sponsor about half of the people who call me their sponsor. And I did some inventory on that. It didn't sit well with me for the rest of the day, although my joke got some laughs, you know. But I realized, you know, that I was sponsoring too many people, or I wasn't sponsoring enough people who called me their sponsor. And so I had to have some difficult conversations that looked something like this. Look, I don't fire anybody, but these are my requirements. And if you're not doing what I require, then I'm doing you a disservice in allowing you to believe that you're being sponsored in AA. Because when you go out and drink, you're going to have to say, I don't know what happened. I was being sponsored in everything, right? And me allowing you to think that was, you know, I think doing more damage than anything. And so I'm current with every single person who calls me their sponsor today. And I'm current with the woman that I call my sponsor, and she's out of my same home group. And you would think after 11 years of sobriety, I wouldn't need somebody that close to me to still keep, but I'm a high maintenance sponsee. I hate to admit that, you know, and everybody grows at different paces. And it just so happens that, you know, I'm still self-will run riot some days, and I still can't see myself clearly. But thank God that I'm still willing to be teachable and to be humble enough to call my sponsor and to say, look, this just happened. What do you suggest I do? Now, if she asks me if I prayed about it and the answer is no, then I just hear a dial tone. but if I say yes, then she's able to ask me some questions that help me to clarify, you know, what I need to take to God and what maybe the next best thing is. So that's what I mean when I say that I have a sponsor, and that's what I mean when I say I'm being sponsored. And I don't tell you these things about sponsoring women and having a home group to impress you. I tell you those things because those are the things that keep me in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is where God has made it abundantly clear that I need to be. I can't sit on the outside. I tried that in AA and it didn't work. You know, my story is one of, I was around AA, right? And then I got a sponsor and started doing the steps, and I was in AA. And today I'm part of AA. I got a home group that is connected to AA as a whole. our voice and our vote matters, and it goes with our delegate to the conference every year. And I am an active member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't always say that, you know, I couldn't always say that. But today I can say that, and I can say that with confidence. There was a point in my sobriety, in my early sobriety, that I thought truly in my heart of hearts, I don't know if I maybe, I probably did say it out loud actually. That I thought that I was here to change AA. And now I realize that AA was here to change Carrie. And that's the way it should be. I had some big ideas when I got here, right? Because our ridiculous literature needed to be updated, our meetings needed to be upgraded, and y'all needed to start acting right. And that's why I'm here, to help you poor people, right? And that's the attitude I came in with. And I will get to my story, but this is heavy on my heart right now. I tell you those things because I didn't care about Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole when I got here. I cared about my own agenda. I cared about me. And having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the 12 steps, I'm a much different person today. In fact, my whole attitude and outlook upon life has changed. But I sit here today, one day after the General Service Conference came to an end. For those of you who don't know, the General Service Conference is a 6-day, 12-hour long per day business meeting that 93 delegates from all over the United States and Canada and 21 trustees sit in a big business meeting and make decisions that are supposed to be based on, you know, the traditions, we would hope, all 36 spiritual principles, we would hope, and also on what the groups that are at the top of the triangle have directed their delegates to carry forth to the conference. The preamble that you read in the beginning of the meeting, that's outdated today. As of today, we have a new preamble. There was a time that I thought AA needed to change drastically. And after the list of agenda items that passed at this year's conference, well, I'll just say that I'm going to move forward with this talk today with a very heavy heart. So, I was born into an alcoholic family. My dad and his entire side of the family is alcoholic. It's all I've ever known. I've never known. The alcoholic life is the only one I've known. My ancestors are all alcoholic. My dad's side of the family is huge, really big. Like we would have, family reunions and there would be about 50 of us, you know, tons of little cousins running around, aunts and uncles. And it was great. Everybody would be drunk. The kids, me, we would be sneaking the beer. We would be, you know, hiding the beer. We would be fighting over the wine and getting in trouble. And that was just, you know, and then on the weekends, my family being very tight knit would, a normal weekend for me would look like everybody getting together, you know, and drinking. That's what we did in my family. That's all we did. And, you know, for a barbecue or whatever, and all the time somebody would end up in the fire, either getting thrown in the fire, falling in the fire drunk. The cops would always be called. Somebody would end up punching somebody. And that was just normal for my, you know, that was just normal. That's how I grew up. And I, in fact, I remember the first time I ever took a drink. I this is my first memory in life. Okay. And I'm not trying to sit here and tell you guys that I think that drinking being my first memory in life is because of my alcoholic brain. I just happen to think that it just happens to be my first memory. I don't think it has anything to do with the fact that I, you know, my first memory as far back as I can go was I was at my Uncle Michael's house. We were having a barbecue, my Uncle Michael and Aunt Carol's house. And it was summertime and there was, you know, a bunch of, I was three. The reason I put myself at 3 years old is because my little sister, who's 2 years younger than me, was still in one of those, like the things that you carry, like the car seats that you can take out and you can carry around or whatever. And she was still in one of those in, you know, this night. And I remember that. And so I'm putting myself at about three, because she would be probably no much older than one. So I could have been four, but anyway, so I was at this barbecue and everybody's drinking and I don't ever remember not knowing what alcohol tasted like. I knew that, you know, adult beverage or none for carry tasted bad because it tasted like, you know, Coors in the can. That's what my dad had. He always had a bunch of Coors in the can, the yellow cans that they used to come in. And that's what he drank my whole growing up, you know, that was always in the fridge. And I don't remember drinking one, but I remember knowing what that tasted like. And so I remember knowing that I wasn't really interested in the stuff that was none for carry anyways. Right. And so, so it never really bothered me. I'm three. What do I know? I'm assuming it didn't bother me. But then this one night in particular, people were drinking something that was an adult beverage that was none for carry. They made that very clear, but it didn't look like it Coors. It very much looked like it would be for carry. So they must have been having like it was summer. So I'm assuming strawberry daiquiris or margaritas or something fancy. It was probably somebody's birthday or something, right? So they were celebrating something. So it wasn't just beer and wine and hard liquor. It was something that looked like, you know, candy or popsicle, right? And I remember thinking, that's funny that they're not offering me that. And they're making it a point that that's, you know, and so I remember thinking I got to taste one of those. Cause I don't think that that is none for carry. That doesn't look like what none for carry tastes like. And so I got my hands on one and I tasted it. And sure enough, I was right. It was absolutely for carry. And I took another drink of it instantly. And instantly I put it down because I didn't want to get caught because I knew that I wanted more. And if I got caught, I would, you know, and so I don't know if it was for the next 10 minutes or the next 1 hour. I don't know that I don't remember. I don't have that, the time frame in my memory, but I do remember that for the next while, 10 minutes or 2 hours, I don't know. My goal was watching people's drinks. This is at 3 years old. I remember watching people's drinks. See, so there was camp chairs around, but this is back in the, you know, I'm 41, I think now. So this was back in the day where the camp chairs, they didn't have the drink holders, right? In like the built-in, in the armrest, you know how now they have the drink holders. They were like those plastic things that like the plastic camp chairs that didn't have drink holders or none of that. And so there were these rounds, firewood rounds that people were putting their drinks on. They were only like 18 inches tall. I'm assuming my Uncle Michael must've had a wood stove or something. And so people were kind of setting their drinks on those, and those were the right height for me. Right. And so using them kind of as coffee tables, I guess. Anyway, the drinks were sitting on those. So they were at my height. I didn't have to like, you know, try and reach or be sneaky or anything. They were right at the perfect height. And I would watch. And when somebody would go into the house to get something to eat or change a diaper or go to the bathroom or whatever the case may be, I would remember watching where they left their drink and waiting until they're all the way in the house and the door closes. And then I go over there, right? And I get something to drink. And I did that for some time. I don't remember how long, again, but I did that for some time. And this I remember clear as day. This I remember clear as day. When I got caught, it was my Aunt Carol. And she said, Carrie Elise. And when she used my last name, my middle name, that's my middle name, Carrie Elise, she said, I wouldn't use my last name on record. She said, and I froze and I had it in my hand and I froze. And I remember going, just put it down. So I put it down and I just looked down and I just pretended I didn't hear her. But when she said that loudly, everyone got quiet. And now everyone's looking at me. And all of a sudden, something really weird happened. It wasn't the same trouble that I got into for hitting my sister or for whatever the case may be that you get in trouble for when you're three. It was different this time because as soon as she said, are you drinking alcohol or whatever she asked me, and I don't remember that. But I mean, I remember this so clearly that I even remember the purple tank top that she was wearing, and it had like lacy purple tank top. Like it's so clear in my memory. And as soon as she said, that she busted me and she pretty much outed me in front of everybody at what she had caught me doing, everybody, instead of getting me in trouble, everybody kind of started laughing. And it wasn't like the trouble that I'd ever gotten in before. People started saying like, oh, how much have you drank, sweetheart? And well, do you want some of mine? And why don't you turn around in a circle and try to walk in a straight line? And I was entertainment all of a sudden. And let me tell you, for the first 2 years of my life was perfect. And then my little sister came along and all the attention went off of me. Now, my little sister, being what I remember is probably 1 year old at this time, had taken all the attention away from me. And I was getting attention for the first time in a while in my memory. And I liked it. And all of a sudden I was the center of attention and I was drinking and being silly and falling down and everybody was paying attention to me and nobody was paying attention to that new little human being in that car seat. And I was happy with that. And so I won't bore you with the next 30 years of my drinking career because it was exactly that. It was about being the center of attention. It was about, I had extreme attention-seeking behavior. I still do today, but thanks to the 12 steps and God, some of those have been removed or alleviated a little bit, but they were bright and shiny walking into AA, let me tell you. But I ended up, you know, that's what kind of a drinker I was. I was a bar drinker. I was not a closet drinker. I was a blackout drinker. I was kicked out of anywhere that I would go pretty much because anytime I was in a bar or a club or anything and there would be a fight, I was absolutely probably, if I'm not part of it, I was the cause of it. Anytime somebody got kicked out for, I don't know, dancing on the bar or taking off their, it was always me, you know, I mean, that had become my role that night at 3 years old. And I've done a ton of inventory over that, you know, when I was new in AA, and I'm so grateful, you know, that God has seen fit to alleviate some of that. And I'm proud to say that it is not my number one character defect any longer. It's moved to like number three. So I guess that's progress. So I got in trouble as a teenager a lot. My first minor in possession of alcohol was when I was 12. And by the time I was 17 years old, I had a juvenile record that was, I had over 20 minor in possession of alcohol. with everything and anything in between. Some class A federal felonies that will never be expunged or removed because they were class A. I didn't know anything about that at the time. Not that I would have done anything different, I'm sure, but so I got in a lot of trouble with alcohol growing up in the small town in Washington that I lived. I was sentenced to some AA meetings. I had to go to some AA meetings with my dad. You know, and like I said, my dad's entire side of the family is alcoholic, I'm not talking about most of us. I'm talking about when I was 2 years sober. I went to yet another funeral, you know, and saw yet another one of my family members who was about 90 pounds. You know, we died about 90 pounds puking blood from this disease, and always between the ages 40 and 60. We don't make it past 60. And then there's a lot of us. You know, my grandparents both died of alcoholism. I mean, everybody. And so I started kind of losing hope, you know, and I started doing some research and into my family tree and researching my ancestors to see if there was anybody who made it past that age. And I found my dad's mom's sister. So my great aunt, she made it past 60, and I found her, and she was 80 years old. And the reason I didn't know her, because we're a tight-knit family, right, is because she was 35 years sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So of course she was the dirty little secret, right? Nobody wants to talk about great Aunt Aya because how ashamed are we of her? So, you know, that offered me some hope, needless to say. And she was one of the first recovered alcoholics I had ever met. I was 2 years into AA, still kind of thinking that we just go to lots of meetings and not drink in between, and, you know, meeting a day will keep the drink away. And like, I was, I must have not been 2 years sober yet when I met my great aunt Aya. She definitely offered me, meeting her offered me hope. And I'll tell you, just, you know, the last summer before the pandemic, I got to celebrate her 90th birthday with her, at the town that we used to have our family reunions in Bridgeport, California, where we would go to a horse ranch every year. That's where we had our family reunions. And that's where my family is buried too, in the cemetery in Bridgeport, California. And her and I got to go to our first AA meeting together on a Wednesday night on her 90th birthday in Bridgeport, California. And then after the AA meeting, we got to go and visit, all of our dead, you know, all of our family that died of this disease. And it was really a wonderful experience to be able to share that with her on her 90th birthday. It's a gift of this program that I will never, you know, it's so special to me. So, you know, AA has given me her as well. You know, when I got sentenced to AA, you know, at like 13 years old, and I was in AA, like with my dad having to sign, my dad did stay sober in AA for 6 years. He was fellowship sober. You know, he went to a lot of meetings. He never sponsored. he never, you know, got into like service work or, he was fellowship sober. And as soon as it, you know, as soon as his, it, anyway, as soon as something went wrong, he drank. And, And that's not anything he ever got back, you know, sobriety. It's not. And that's why I don't take it for granted. I know that what I've been given is a gift, and I'm not going to take it for granted. So I would go to my, I would go to some AA meetings with my dad when I was like 13, because I had to get my court signed, my court slip signed card. And I just remember just hating it. And I didn't have to go to that many. I don't think like maybe 10 or 12 or something like that. But I just remember thinking, oh my God. And I'm not even blaming it on AA. It's not about like, it wasn't, I don't know if it's not like they were bad meetings or anything like that. I just like, I was not at all ready. I did not want anything that you guys had, you know, at 13 years old. I remember the nice little old lady who was probably 30 who came up to me at the time and said to me, that Carrie, you never have to drink again if you don't want to. And I'm like, is that a threat? Because that sounds like a threat to me. You know, I don't not want to drink. I'm sorry. You got that all wrong. You must be talking about somebody else. And so it wasn't about, you know, not AA was my first time into AA, I consider, not because I had to be there because of a judge or a probation officer or, you know, whatever, a hearing. I had the first time I came into AA for me was the day after my 30th birthday. So you can only imagine what a S show my 30th birthday was. times whatever you're thinking by 10 and you might be halfway there. So the day after my 30th birthday, I came in to my first meeting on my own accord, and I was crying. And I didn't want to be here, and I didn't want what you had. And I didn't want to be friends with a bunch of alcoholics. You know, my family was alcoholic, and I spent 20 years trying to prove that I was going to be the first non-alcoholic born in my family. You know, I mean, and that is what my drinking career consisted of. Not when I was a teenager, but when I was an adult, my drinking career really didn't consist of, you know what? I want to go out and drink for oblivion tonight. I never did that. Like, I get it. I hear people in AA saying things like, one drink. What is the point of that? Who would want a drink? Me. I wanted a drink. I wanted one drink. I wanted to be able to have one glass of champagne at somebody's wedding without kissing the groom, punching the bride, and falling over the balcony naked in my own puke. Like, that's it. One. That's all I wanted. You know, I just want one drink. I want to be normal enough to have maybe two beers on pizza night, you know, like everybody else. I want to be able to have one margarita when you go to a Mexican restaurant, because that's normal. I want to have one glass of wine, even though I hate wine, with an Italian dish, because that's what grownups do. Now, unfortunately, I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, which apparently makes me alcoholic. The doctor's opinion calls it an allergy. And if you look up the definition of an allergy in a 1939 dictionary, which I did, it's an abnormal reaction to food or substance. Well, I definitely have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. My abnormal reaction to alcohol is not something that grew on me. I had an abnormal reaction to alcohol since the get. You know, it's not an addiction. You know, I mean, you can't be addicted to something you've never done before. And I remember, you know, that first time I took a drink at age 3, I had an abnormal reaction, and I've never had a normal relationship with alcohol ever. I also, toward the end of my drinking career, I wasn't addicted. I wasn't physically dependent. I had never been through DTs. I never had to go to the detox. And that was a hurdle when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I really appreciate and treasure, and really respect the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if they weren't here, I'm not sure that I would be here. If those 12 traditions weren't in place to where I couldn't identify, then I'm not sure that I would be here. Because I didn't do you know, the first meetings that I went into when I was ready to come in, I didn't identify. And you know, it's because I heard things like smoking, snorting, shooting, all of these things that I didn't, you know, that's not, I'm a drunk. And I always thought you guys were maybe worse off than me, or you guys were different than me. And on the bottom of page 20, it talks about a heavy drinker. And when it talks about a heavy drinker on the bottom of page 20, on a, up into the top of page 21, it's talking about a non-alcoholic. But that non-alcoholic who can stop or moderate given a sufficient reason, ill health, falling in love, warning of a doctor, becomes operative. This man can stop or moderate, although it may be troublesome, and he may even need medical attention. That means this guy could even be physically addicted to alcohol, but he's not an alcoholic. Anybody can become addicted to alcohol. It's an addictive substance, duh. But that doesn't make you alcoholic. Only one out of every 10 people are alcoholic. And my neighbor, four, five doors down, she, when I first got sober, I didn't know about the traditions, right? But as soon as I had that spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, I was like over the moon and telling anybody and everybody in line at the grocery store or wherever that I am an AA member, right? Like I wanted to bring everybody in. And I must have told my neighbor and she comes knocking on my door one day and she's elderly, probably 85, 90 years old. And she said, you know, that she's like, are you still an alcoholic? And I said, yeah, I don't even know this lady. And she's like, well, I'm worried about something. I might be too. And I said, well, what's the matter? And she tells me, my doctor, I have to get a hip replacement. And my doctor said that I have to not have any, consume any alcohol for 48 hours beforehand. And so I didn't drink last night and I'm like shaking. And I said, oh my God, yeah, you're probably an alcoholic. I'm diagnosing her. And she says, and I said, well, how often do you drink? And she said, every night. And I said, oh, every night? I didn't even drink every night. Oh my God, you're probably an alcoholic. I said, how much do you drink? And she says, well, some nights I finish my glass of wine. And I said, well, you mean the glass of wine, right? Like a bottle sized glass of wine. She goes, no, I only have one glass. I never. And I said, do you ever accidentally drink more than you mean to? And she says, no, I've never even been drunk in your life. Nope. And I'm going, oh my God, like this is stumping me, right? Well, she goes to her doctor and her doctor said, well, after 40 years of drinking 4 ounces of wine every single night, then she got physically dependent on it. And this woman, it scared her enough to, apparently she just stopped drinking because she didn't want to be physically dependent on something after her surgery. Her surgery went well. She's fine. I saw her at the mailbox a couple of years ago. She still lives here. And I asked her, you know, hey, how's that not coming to AA and not drinking thing going, you know, cause I'm thinking that she's really one of us, you know? And she says, great. And she has champagne at her granddaughter's wedding and she doesn't drink at home anymore, but she like has a glass of wine at Christmas and she drinks with impunity and she's still never been drunk to this day. She just got physically dependent on alcohol. Who knew, right? Because the next paragraph on page 21 says, and I'm part of the page 21 club. Look, I got a tattoo to prove it. Like, I want to make sure that I never forget about that. I tattooed it to my skull. So on page 21, it says, but what about the real alcoholic? Oh, so just because you're physically addicted to alcohol doesn't make you an alcoholic? Nope. What is a real alcoholic then? Well, he may or may not start out, or, well, it says he may or may not become a serious daily drinker. He may not become dependent on alcohol. That was me. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his intake once he starts to drink. That's me. I have a phenomenon of craving once I start to drink to where I don't stop until I run out, blackout, or pass out. And then once I come to, right, and I swear it off forever, looking at all the orange puke all over myself, going my pissed pants, and somebody broke into my house and peed right where I sleep. And, you know, it's all over my pajama bottoms. And I'm like, oh my God, how did I get home? And who was I with? And what did I do? And all that stuff. And I swear it off forever, saying I'm never going to drink again. And then two nights later, I'm drunk again. That's my mental obsession. Because I have a college party living in my head telling me drink, 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 drink 24/7. And if I'm not insanely drunk, because I'm rarely mildly intoxicated, then I'm recovering from maybe a 2 to 3 day hangover. And if I'm not insanely drunk or recovering from a 2 to 3 day hangover, then I'm planning the next cocktail party. I'm planning the next ladies' night out. I'm planning the next, you know, so 24/7 up in here. And that's an alcoholic, you know? And so as soon as I realized that, as soon as the old man in my home group, and thank God for you old timers who cared more about my life than my feelings. Thank God that you guys didn't believe in this no crosstalk, whatever the treatment center calls it, because AA meetings, they are crosstalk. They are where newcomers come to get help. Like, that's what we do. That's what we do for a whole hour. That's the definition of an AA meeting. And so I, you know, I'm sitting in this AA meeting, and this old timer asshole at the time, thank you, Hank, rip, rest in peace. Now, he cross-talked me like a good old timer would do. And he says, you know, after I got done sharing, complaining, how different I am than all of you, you know, because I didn't drink for 40 years like you guys. And I didn't, you know, drink a bottle of scotch first thing in the morning, as soon as I rolled out of bed, like you guys. And, you know, and he says, look, little girl, he waited like a polite gentleman until I was done whining. He didn't interrupt me, but he shared next. And he said, look, little girl, that's what he used to call me. He said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how long you've drank for, how long you've been drinking. It doesn't matter how much you drink when you drink. It doesn't matter how often you drink when you drink. What matters is what happens when you drink. That's what makes a real alcoholic, you know? And then he took me there in the big book and in the doctor's opinion to the place that said all of these types of alcoholics, all of these types. And it goes through 5 different types, if anybody's listened to the Joe and Charlie tapes in the doctor's opinion. And he takes me to the place that says all of these types and many others have one symptom in common. Not 10, not 5, not 2. Not road rage, not an inferiority complex, not an egomaniac. Those are human problems. One symptom in common. We cannot start drinking without developing that phenomenon of craving. And I had that phenomenon of craving from the get. And so once I realized that I'm a real alcoholic, I'm the real deal. Well, I realized what the big book wants me to realize. I'm screwed. And without spiritual help, I'm going to either die or go permanently insane. And so I started getting into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with a recovered sponsor. I started taking this thing seriously. I mean, at this point I had a sponsor. I got a sponsor that I didn't call, a big book that I didn't read, and a home group I didn't attend. And for some reason it wasn't working, as the program of As Carrie Sees It was just getting me drunk over and over again. So I finally got serious, after about 9 months, actually 9 months to the day, that I had been coming into AA. And I started going through the book with a recovered alcoholic. And where it said, we didn't skip around, and she didn't change anything in the big book for my feelings or for my comfort level. She didn't take anything out. She didn't add anything to. We read it word for word, line by line, page by page. And where it said, do, we did. And where it said, pray, we prayed. And where it said, write, we wrote. And And in the third step, I turned my will and my life over to the care of a higher power, not on a daily basis. I made a commitment, a once in a lifetime decision. That was the biggest decision that I had ever made. And it's not something that I say every morning and think that I'm doing a third step. That's what I was doing before when I couldn't get sober. It's a commitment like marriage vows. And beneath the third step prayer, it says in the big book, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. These are not things that, you know, that come with, yeah, I woke up this morning and I went pee and I did a steps 1, 2, 3, and then I had my coffee. No, this was a huge decision for me. This was a huge decision. You know, it was like it was like marriage vows. And do I take my will back all day, every day? That's what step 11 is for, right? It's step 11 that says we constantly say to ourselves, remind ourselves as we go throughout the day, thy will not mine be done, over and over again, right? But just because, I mean, I took marriage vows with my husband and I'm not the perfect wife. And every time I tell him to go screw off, I don't have to go get remarried the next day, right? I haven't changed my mind about that decision. I have a loving and forgiving higher power, just like I have a loving and forgiving husband. And I haven't changed my mind about that decision since the day I got down on my knees with my sponsor and I took the third step. And that's the wording it's used out of the big book. And then I took my fourth step and my fifth step. Not perfectly, but I didn't write a novel. I did that right. She told me it was not a feeling finding and emotion having process. It's a fact finding and fact facing process. And I did that right, you know? And then in step 5, when it was safe, that's when I could start having the feelings and the emotions because I'm safe within with a sponsor and not just alone in my own head. Because I've seen so many people go out on their fourth step because of morbid reflection. So I'm glad that I had a sponsor that just told me to do exactly word for word what's in the big book, right? It says fact finding and fact facing. So then in 6 and 7, I was able to finally, I did a lot of work in 4 and 5. So it was a relief to find out that 6 and 7 were God's steps. God gets to do those steps. I just have to let him, right? Because I can't fix this with this. So now I get to just give it over to God and say, I humbly offer myself to you, the good and the bad. I don't get to decide what you take or when. Like, I'm out of that business, right? I have a new employer. God gets to decide. I just have to be humbly ready and willing to let him take those things. And he hasn't seen fit to take them all yet, but that's okay. Because the seventh step prayer says, the things which stand in the way of my usefulness. Well, maybe some of my defects he's still using. I don't know, but guess what? It's none of my business. It's none of my business. And so I get to clean up the wreckage of my past in steps 8 and 9. And then in step 10, I get to continue taking personal inventory as I go along. And I get to, the step 10 is a 5-part process. For those of you who, unless you're used to hearing about step 10 in a meeting and then you have to wait till the end of the day to do it, which, oh God, I would hate that. Anyway, my big book tells me that the evening review is right after it says the 11th step suggests. And so I take my evening review during my 11th step, but throughout the day is when I take my 10th step. And it says it's 5 parts. It says, as I go throughout my day, I watch for character defects. It names those defects in particular, but for short, I watch for character defects. When, not if they crop up. When, not if they crop up, I ask God at once to remove them. Then I talk to another alcoholic. That's why when I call my sponsor before I've asked God to remove them, she says, have you prayed? And I say no, and she hangs up, right? Because I'm doing that 10th step out of order. After I talk to my sponsor, Then I make sure that I don't owe any amends. And if I do, I clean it up promptly, not wait until the end of the night when I'm doing an inventory. That's not when I'm doing my inventory at the end of the night. That'd be way too late. So I clean it up promptly, and then I resolutely turn my thoughts to someone I can help, which means resolutely means to resolve the situation. Hopefully by the end of the night, when I'm doing my 11th step review, everything has been resolved and I get to kind of check those boxes, right? And thank God, when we, my sponsor and I, because I didn't do this thing alone, when we got to page, the 10th step is on page 84. It's easy to find because it says in italics, this thought brings us to step 10. I don't know how people are so clueless as to where these steps are, because like they're written in italics wherever one starts in the big book. So after step 10, then we come down to this paragraph that I've lovingly come to know as the 10th step promises, that I didn't know this would have been the carrot before the horse for me. If somebody would have told me these things could come true in the beginning, I would have been much more apt to do the steps. So my sponsor says, now it's your turn to read. And I started reading here, and I says, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. Even alcohol? I've never ceased fighting alcohol before in my life. I would get in the ring with King Alcohol and I would get knocked out and get right back up for round two. I didn't tap out. I'd get right back up for round three, right back up for round four. I never tapped out, never. And by the time I got to this place in the book, it occurred to me when I read that I had tapped out. I hadn't been drunk in 6 months. I had ceased fighting alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we find that this has happened automatically. We feel that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. Temptation, I was going to avoid temptation for the rest of my life. I thought that was the program. Use your resources, call human power. If you pick up the phone, if you want a drink, stay away from the bars. The bars, I couldn't even go down the cheese aisle because it shared the aisle with the beer when I was new. I couldn't even buy cheese in the grocery store because I couldn't avoid temptation. And now it says that we feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. My sponsor said, when's the last time you thought of drinking? I couldn't remember. It had been weeks, maybe months. This mind of a chronic alcoholic with the sound of a college party telling me drink, drink, drink had stopped. It was silenced. We haven't even sworn it off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Wow. That means I'm a recovered alcoholic. I don't even think about drinking anymore. Where is my diploma? Give me my certificate. I am out. Thank you, AA. Right? Fixed. 100%. Whoa, slow your roll, Carrie. Yes, steps 1 through 9, taken, allow us to recover from alcoholism, like the first promise in the big book on the title page says. But it's not a 9-step program. We're given 3 additional steps, which this next paragraph calls maintenance, right? And so in order to stay this way, I have to start learning how to live in steps 10, 11, and 12. And it warns me, it's easy to let up on this spiritual program of action and rest on my laurels. And I can see where it would be. But for somebody like me, recovering from alcoholism was the hardest thing I've ever had to do, and I've given birth. I would much rather stay a recovered alcoholic than have to go through that again. I've been a practicing alcoholic, a recovering alcoholic, and now that I'm a recovered alcoholic, I know that there's only one of those 3 phases of my development that I will never go through again. I might have another drink in me, but I do not have another recovery in me. I know that to be true. So I have to stay recovered. I have to keep in fit spiritual condition. And what this paragraph tells me is that what we really have is a daily reprieve. Thank God it doesn't say contingent on our spiritual condition. It doesn't say that we have a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. If it said that, then I would probably be drunk time and time again because I am not in fit spiritual condition every day. What it says is that we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Maintenance is an action word. So it's contingent on the actions I'm willing to take, even when I don't want to, right? And that I'm willing to pick up the phone when a sponsee is calling to complain about her husband's program for the 10th time. I'm willing to pick up the phone even when I don't want to. I'm willing to show up for a meeting when I have a migraine headache because I just heard what the board at the General Service Office decided to do at conference, even when I don't want to. I get to suit up and show up and do the next right thing even when I don't want to. I get to take a personal inventory daily and take honest stock of where I've been wrong during the day and talk to another alcoholic about that. And I never want to do that, but I do it anyways because that's the maintenance, right? And this is a program of action. It's not a program of acceptance. I don't work out of the back of the book. Hell, Dr. Paul's story. I love Dr. Paul's story, but acceptance just got me more drunk. Once I realized I accepted I was an alcoholic, it's like gloves are off. Give me the booze. I'm an alcoholic. I got it. I'm accepting it, right? Bring it on. But this is a program of action. And one of the things that my sponsor reminds me is wanting to is not a requirement, right? Feeling like doing this stuff is not a requirement. Just doing it. That's it. Just do it. And I've been blessed and graced with the God has been so awesome to me to give me and to continue to provide me the willingness to take the action even when I don't want to. And that's why I'm still sober today. Every day is a day where we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. That sure sounds like a third step to me, right? Nope, I took my third step. That's in step 10. The principle of this third step is all over steps 10 and 11. And I get to practice that every day. The highlight of my life today is working with others. You know, I love speaking. I love going to my home group. I love doing service in general service and district and area and all that. But what keeps the fire alive in me today is sitting across the table with another alcoholic, going through this book and watching life come back into somebody whose soul has been dead for years. And with that, thank you so much for having me at your meeting today. It was great to meet all of you guys, and it's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Hi, everybody. My name is Dale, and I'm an alcoholic. And Carrie, I want to just thank you for coming from the Pacific Northwest to our little town here in Virginia, our little meeting, and sharing a message of depth and weight with us this evening. And also want to thank all those who are returning to our group and those that are here for the first time that came along with Carrie or with another friend to join us this evening. We appreciate you being here and hope you come back. I'm going to do a little quick close here, and then we'll all be able to unmute so that we can share amongst ourselves and thank Carrie.